You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. On to some curious scientific questions now. For example, what's the relationship between pain and itch? And what about sex equality in scientific studies? Joining us now is regular Pulse contributor, SciCurious, Bethany Brookshire. She's a writer for Science News and Society for Science and the Public. Hi, Bethany.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you. Let's start with itch, pain, and then there is kind of serotonin in the middle. There's some new research on that, and that's of personal interest to you, right?
Yes, it is. I suffer from a condition called atopic dermatitis. It's sometimes called eczema, and this means that I itch all the time. So what I found particularly interesting about this is that, you know, many of us have had an itch before. Like, say we have a mosquito bite and you have this horrible itch. So you go to scratch it and you scratch it and you feel so much better, right?
Right.
But then all of a sudden it itches again.
And worse.
You know how the itch comes back, right? It comes back and it's worse. So basically what happens is when you scratch an itch, you actually create pain. And itch and pain share similar nerve pathways in the spinal cord. They actually come down the same way and ascend the same way. And so when you scratch your itch, you produce pain. To kill the pain, your body produces serotonin. But the serotonin comes out near the pain neurons and hits also the itch neurons. And when it hits the itch neurons, it activates them to itch more. So the serotonin kills the pain, but it increases the itch.
So now what? What do we do with this knowledge?
It could help us actually find ways to combat chronic itch. So there's a specific receptor that receives serotonin on the itch neurons. It's called the serotonin 1A receptor. And if we could target that receptor with, say, drugs that specifically target it, we could actually help people who suffer from chronic itch.
And has it changed how you itch and scratch? Or just is it just good to know that there's a reason why the itch comes back?
You know, I really wish that it had changed my behavior.
Let's move on to sex equality in scientific studies. The NIH has announced a new policy that will promote sex parity in research. What is this all about?
It's actually a rolling policy. It's coming out in stages, and no one really knows what the final result's gonna be like. But the National Institutes of Health, or NIH, funds over 300,000 researchers in this country and in other countries to produce, you know, scientific research to help human health. And much of that research until recently has actually been done primarily on one sex or the other. So for example, a lot of neuroscience research is primarily done in male animals, and a lot of like immunological research tends to be done on cells from female animals. There's various reasons. Many people think that in neuroscience, for example, when you're studying behavior, it's harder to study females because they have, you know, menstrual cycles, and that can be difficult. There's lots of reasons why people prefer to investigate one sex or the other. But this means when things translate up to clinical trials for a new drug, for example, we don't necessarily always know how it's going to affect both sexes because it's only been investigated in males or only in females.
So what could the changes look like?
Well, it's tough to say so far. Right now, the first goal is to actually get all scientists to declare in their published papers what sex of animal they used. But there are some thoughts that eventually the NIH will require all experiments to be conducted in both males and females. So if you conduct a study on, say, the long-term effects of Prozac, you have to look both in male and female rats.
But do I have, as a woman, more in common with a female mouse than I do with a male mouse? Is the difference really that big?
It can be, yeah. Certainly, hormones can strongly affect many things in the body. And, you know, males also have hormonal cycling. It just is on a very different schedule compared to females. It tends to be more daily or hourly as opposed to, you know, monthly. Or in the case of, you know, mice and rats, it's every few days.
And what are you hearing from your scientist friends? Is there a bit of grumbling about this, or do people see it as a necessary step?
Opinions appear to be divided. A lot of people welcome it as a very necessary step. Of course, we should be looking at both sexes. I mean, that seems really obvious. But there are some concerns because if you're going to look in both sexes to make the statistics work out, you really need to double the number of animals. You need to have twice the number of animals that you have, you know, 10 males and 10 females per experiment and per condition. So if you're looking at several doses of drug, you need 10 males and 10 females per dose for the experiment. And a lot of people are wondering who's going to pay for that. You know, these animals aren't cheap. They're expensive. They require a lot of care. So how are grants going to be funded to actually pay for those experiments?
So it sounds like a rather complicated process ahead of us. And Bethany, finally this week, I wanted to ask you about some new research on white nose syndrome with bats.
Yeah, there's a new paper just come out this week in Proceedings of the Royal Society B, looking at the seasonality of white nose syndrome and how bats vary in the amount of bats that carry white nose syndrome and are suffering from the disease throughout the year. And it's because bats have a very distinct yearly timeline. And the animals get reinfected in the winter when they're hibernating. And when they hibernate, bats actually have a lower body temperature than they do when they're active. The lower body temperature is really nice and comfortable for the fungus. And so the fungus has a chance to spread and kill more bats during the winter when the animals are hibernating.
And will that knowledge potentially help scientists cure this syndrome?
The authors certainly hope it will help treatments because now they know when they need to target the treatment. So if you have a new treatment that you think might help combat white nose, you don't want to necessarily give it in the spring, you know, when the animals are becoming active again. You want to actually give it during the winter when they're most likely to be infected. So it might actually help people time their treatments and help prevent the spread.
Bethany Brookshire, also known as SciCurious, writes for Science News and also for the educational blog Eureka Lab. Bethany, thank you so much.
Thank you.